This program is brought to you by Resonance 104.4 FM. If you like what you hear and want to support our work, please make a donation at fundraiser.resonance.fm.
Intolerable kid on the Nova Lark. We were on the knot after a rumble in the Crab Nebula involving this two-way time stop. When you come to the end of a biologic film, just run it back and start over. Nobody knows the difference, like nobody there before the film. So they start to run it back and the projector blew up and we land out of there on the blast. Hold up in those cool blue mountains on the knot. A heavy blue mist drifting across the floor, and the liquid air in our spines, listening to a little hi-fi jump note, fixes you right to metal, and you nod out a thousand years. Yes, sitting there in orange flesh robes, the blue mist drifting around us when we get the call. And as soon as I set foot on Podunk Earth, I can smell it. That burnt metal reek of Nova. Already set off the charge, I said to I&I, immovable and irresistible. This is a burning planet. So intolerable I&I sniffs and says, yeah. When it happens fast. This is a rush job. You can feel it there under your feet, the whole structure buckling like a bulkhead about to blow. So the paper has a car there for us, and we are driving in from the airport, the kid at the wheel and his foot on the floor. Nearly ran down a herd of pedestrians, and they yell after us, "What you want to do, kill somebody?" And the kid sticks his head out and screams, "It would be a pleasure." His eyes lit up like a blowtorch, and I can see he's really in form. So we start right to work making our headquarters in the land of the free where the call came from, and which is really free and wide open for any life form, the uglier the better. Well, they don't come any uglier than the intolerable kid and your reporter. He's a great guy, the kid, or at least he's big. But Jesus Christ, I hate him. Everyone does, that being his profession. When a planet is all primed to go up, they call in I&I to jump around from one faction to the other, agitating and insulting all the parties before and after the fact. You have to move fast on this job.
Good afternoon. You're listening to Wavelength on Resonance 104.4 FM and www.resonancefm.com on the net. My name's William English, and this week's guest is Jim Pennington.
Hiya.
Hello, Jim. Thank you for coming back. You've been on once or twice before.
I have. Twice, I think.
Twice? Yeah. You are a publisher of ALO's books.
That's right, yes. Yes, sir. I plead guilty.
Yep.
Anything else I do?
Which has been going since when?
Oh.
When did you start?
Early 70s.
Right.
Bit of a gap of stuff when we didn't do stuff. But publishing, I like to call myself actually a senior researcher for Allo's books rather than a publisher. Because if you say you're a publisher, people say you other poets' eyes light up.
Oh yeah,
and they think they should.
There's an opportunity here. Yeah,
an opportunity.
Is there not an opportunity then for you poets? Can they not write in now, having heard you, offer their manuscripts to you?
No unsolicited manuscripts unless they are sent with a stamped addressed envelope, and the stamp's far in excess of the value that they need to return.
I detect a note of cynicism, which has probably established itself over the years of reading many, many poetry manuscripts.
Well, actually, not that many, but funnily enough, I came across exactly the same sentiment in a book I'm reading at the moment, which is a biography of Genet by Edmund White. And he's talking about one of the publishers that worked with Genet in the very early days, in the 40s and 50s. And he had the same thing as well, where he didn't like to be introduced at parties as a publisher, precisely because it meant that people
suddenly
differently
homed in on it.
Yeah, yeah. Right. So I call myself a researcher. But it goes back to
Who was it? Do you remember the name of that publisher?
I think it was a guy called Guérin, and the publishing was Morihen.
Oh, yeah.
Morihen. I think.
Okay.
Because my memory serves me badly. And just now, listening to the piece that we opened up with there, which is Burroughs reading The Intolerable Kid Routine, which comes from Nova Express. Well, it comes from everywhere. And he's coming from Nova Express. And I had to look up where I'd taken that recording from, which is from a flexi in a magazine called Talk Talk that came out of Lawrence, Kansas in 1981.
Right.
Edited it's so small on the mobile here. It's edited by Grauholtz. And if not edited by Grauholtz, then the backing band had some of Grauholtz in it.
I wondered what that was. I wondered if he'd just left the radio on in the background.
I wish he'd turned it off, actually.
it was a deliberate accompaniment then, was it? It was like a three-minute track, isn't it?
I'm always distressed by the putting of music behind Burroughs' reading. Look, they all do it. Laswell did it, was it? And didn't Gus Van Sant do it? But it's because I reckon his voice is so sharp and, shall we call it, charismatic, that it doesn't really need to have a musical accompaniment.
No.
The only place where it did work was on that Christmas story, where A Junkie's Christmas.
All right.
And there, it is very much as if the radio is on the background and they're playing Christmas songs.
So it sounds like ambient music.
It's
like
ambient.
It's part of the atmosphere rather than a kind of deliberate accompaniment.
Yeah.
So is that a rare recording, this flexi disc?
It probably is.
Yeah. It doesn't appear anywhere else, does it?
I can't remember that particular thing appears anywhere else. It may well have been compiled in a couple of these. There was a Sub Rosa compilation. Nothing Here Now But the Recordings, or was that?
Yeah.
Either which way. The bits of Burroughs turn up in some slightly unauthorized compilations, as I understand it. But it's certainly, as a flexi, it's a fair rarity. I mean, I bought it for £25 off of internet only a year or so ago, so it ain't that special.
Right.
Mind you, I went for the cheapest copy. slightly over the top American bookseller who wanted to do it for like $300.
Wow.
It came with the magazine. The magazine's nice enough. I'll tell you what, there's a really interesting piece in it, in that they also reproduced a couple of Burroughs's collages, which I'd never seen before.
Right.
And there were a series of three collages that appeared in the Paris Review, article in 1965. And this was one of them that never appeared. And the story behind it was that the son of the editor of Paris Review at the time, or the son of the bloke who did the Inventure. Was that George Plimpton? No. Was it?
Not sure.
Either which way, it's these collages of really early collage work by Burroughs had obviously disappeared into the magazine's archives, and the person who did the article or the editor rescued them or kept them, and then finally his son had them, and he allowed one of them to be used by the magazine, although it's a rather difficult provenance that when you have artwork as a publisher, as to who owns it, what it's there for, why you still got it, why didn't you give it back to the artist. I'm speaking rather guiltily here of a few pieces that I've had.
What, of Burroughs?
God, I wish I had. Yeah. I wish I had, but when I was doing it, they were nice. You didn't sort of feel acquisitive about them. You just thought they were nice pieces. You thought, I might stick that up on the wall one of these days.
So have you published any Burroughs?
Yes, we did a Burroughs collection of pieces that was in a collection of pieces that.
Sorry, I should have said, have you researched any Burroughs? Of course,
research.
Yes.
Yes. Well, a lot of research went into The White Subway, which was our collection of Mimeo magazine articles, which we did in the mid-70s. Then we did a thing called Snack, which was a transcript of a radio program that Eric Mottram had done in 64. I think it was the very first radio program about Burroughs. And this is a cue for the opening track for the next thing on that CD.
Okay.
Which do you
want to, should we run that now?
Yeah, let's
run it. We can let it run, and you can talk over the top if you want, or whatever you want to do.
Let's run it now. And
I write with the intention of altering and expanding states of consciousness in myself, and I hope in the readers as well. I feel that any writer is certainly endeavoring to produce alterations in the consciousness of his readers. If he isn't doing that, he certainly isn't doing anything.
I then asked William Burroughs who he wrote for.
A writer is essentially a mapmaker of psychic areas, and I am writing for people who would be visiting or have visited the same areas. That is, I am writing for cosmonauts of inner space, people who are interested in exploring unexplored psychic areas. There are very few living writers who are verbal innovators and experimenters, as Gertrude Stein and James Joyce were innovators and experimenters. Nobody seems to ask the question what words actually are and exactly their relationship to the human nervous system.
Next, I asked him how he evaluated the work that he had already done.
It's a super little dialogue going on there. But what puzzles me, listening to it on these headphones, you really get feeling there, certainly in the second, when he answered the second question, answered the first question, that's the person, the producer, had stuck a few things together, because there's a strange kind of up and down in the volume. At least I noticed on the headline. When it comes to that phrase, cosmonauts of inner space.
Yeah. You think it's a collage? You think it's been you think it's been edited, perhaps?
It's been edited. Maybe the pause. It's been edited out for the pauses, perhaps, or it's worth a bit of forensics on it, perhaps. But irrespective of that, it's...
When does that date from? You say from the
61.
60s? 61. And is that Eric Mottram's voice, then?
No. This is a bloke called Gary Goldhill. I only know this because I acquired this CD. It's a copy from the BBC archives. Goodness knows, and I won't tell you how I acquired it, because probably I shouldn't have it. certainly shouldn't be. it came with the pieces of paper that say how long the track is, when it took place, and who the interviewer was. And the interviewer is a guy called Gary Goldhill. I'd never heard of him before. And But when you Google him now, I tried to find who he was. I've had that about 15 years, that CD. At the time, I couldn't pin down who this Gary Goldhill was. But I only just recently pinned him down. And in 61, he was a budding BBC interviewer, radio person. I don't know what else he did other than that interview. That was never broadcast, by the way, that interview. What happened was that Eric Mottram took it and used bits of it for his particular program, Algebra of Need. And there are about, the recording's 32 minutes. Gary Goldhill doesn't say very much in it. So there's, like, shall we say, at least 22 minutes of Burroughs. And Eric only used about 15 minutes. So there's little bits like that opening paragraph, that opening thing, wasn't in Algebra of Need.
Okay. What was Algebra of Need then?
Algebra of Need was the radio the program that Mottram did, which was the first sort of literary, shall we call it, literary study of Burroughs. Okay. And it went on to be the first definitive study as a book published by Marion Boyers. And there was a big gap then until I think Tony Tanner did a study of Burroughs as part of a long thing about modern literature. And the next one would have been the Jenny Skirl book. And interestingly enough, I'd never read the Jenny Skirl book, and I saw a copy on eBay and I bought the book, and I asked the bloke whether he had any other Burroughs stuff, and he said he did, and he said I got that book on I got the Jenny Skirl said to me I should get the Algebra of Need, although not because it's any good but because it was the first study.
Right.
And it was quite interesting that Jenny Skirl should refer to this study as not particularly good.
Right.
Although the words she used were the confusing linguistic attitude or something slightly more convincing than not very good.
Yeah. You have done, your ALOS publishers has done various pirated editions, I think.
We did. There was something slightly untoward about a couple of the later Fincham pamphlets, but piracy, I wouldn't spend too much time on their provenance, really. But going back to this Goldhill character, okay? Because I ain't finished the remarkable thing that I then discovered in reading. Goldhill took acid we're talking 61, 62 now, okay? So he takes acid and disappears off to, he goes off to California, San Francisco, and he takes the acid there and ends up joining the Diggers and Ken Kesey and that crowd. And designs, ends up being a poster artist, and some of his work is this standard psychedelic poster stuff you see for Haight Ashbury and the Bill Graham concerts. And he's mentioned in the Ken Kesey book. That's Tom Wolfe. He's mentioned in the context of Ken Kesey books, probably Electric Kool-Aid Acid Test. And I haven't managed to be able to come into any kind of modern times references. He may or may not still be alive.
Right.
And it would be fascinating if he were.
Yeah.
He might even be listening now.
Yeah.
So I want to. That's a nice bit of research. I'm going to pin that bloke down.
Okay. Well, this doesn't lead on at all to what we're supposed to be talking about, but we better just jump onto that now, which is David, how do you pronounce him?
I was told two pronunciations, Wojnarowicz or Wojnarowicz.
I tried to announce this program, I think I called him Wojnarowicz, but so it's Wojnarowicz. So the first J is a Woj then, Wojnarowicz.
So I'm assured by my mate Max, who lives with someone who's Polish, so
right.
I guess...
Okay.
I'm assuming it's...
Yeah.
It's a Polish name.
Right.
And yeah, it has to be.
So David Wojnarowicz was... He died quite young, I think. He wrote a memoir called Close to the Knives, a memoir of disintegration, which has been republished 2 or 3 times, I think. But he was mostly a visual artist.
Well, he started off as... He did go to art school, but he started off being a writer in on the Lower East Side writing scene, and he did he wasn't particularly published. There is a very obscure publication in which one of his early routines, they're called the Waterfront Journals. He would record or transcribe his memory of conversations he had with people on the road. And those are the ones that Allos did in the early 80s. It's called the book we did, which we called the collection Sounds in the Distance. And that was his name. That was his what he called the collection. But he actually moved. Away from writing to doing lyrics for songs. He had a band at one stage called Teens Kill Four. I say he had a band. I think they only played very few times, and they may have cut one record.
Right. So did you meet him in the 80s then?
I met him very late at night in a bar in downtown in Soho somewhere, and because my mate Max was working as a busboy in this bar. I think it might have been Danceteria, something like that, one of those ones. And he said that look, this is David, he's written some stuff. I'll get him to send you some. Hello, David, yes. And the noise and people running around, and that was it.
Right.
And then about 2 or 3 weeks later, after I got back to London, he sent me this I call it a copy shop edition. He must have run off about, I don't know how many, 10 or 15 copies of a 48-page A4 single-sided copy shop photocopied thing.
Yeah.
With a picture, with a side stabbed, with a collage of his on the front. Called it Sounds in the Distance, although he was going to change the title. We went through a lot of permutations of what the title should be. It took me ages to do it. I mean, it was about 3 years after he sent me the manuscript that we eventually got it done, because I was...
It sounds like such a sort of fleeting kind of meeting, but then he's entrusted this manuscript to you. That's quite an odd story in a way.
It's because he knew Max, and he'd seen a couple of books that I'd done for Max, and I'd done what had I done before? He'd seen White Subway. So he knew that I wasn't just...
Right. So he liked the style of your publications, basically.
Yeah, he must have done.
Yeah.
And he was pleased that we did it, even though it took a bit of a long time.
Yeah.
By the time we'd done it, he'd actually moved on to being more of a photographer stroke visual artist and performance artist.
Right.
And then he finally...
Have you still got this manuscript? In your own archive? I mean, you've got this original.
But it's a photocopy thing. It's not
right.
But
still,
And there were bits of it that we didn't use in our reinterpretation of it, and which is why I just recently revisited it and got together some of the pieces that I'd not included in Sounds in the Distance, and did this little thing that we did the other day, a couple of months ago rather, which we called Seven Sounds. I did it, and what I wanted to do was to do something on this little Gestetner machine I've been foodling about with. I've done two other, I call them mini Mimeos. They're like A6, and they're sidestab with a wrap-round cover. And I like the format, and I'd done two of them with an artist called Alexander Adams, and then I thought, let's do three with Alex, actually. And so I put together some of the pieces that hadn't appeared in Sounds in the Distance.
Was that his first published work?
It was his first proper published work, right, as opposed to a manuscript he was handing around amongst his mates.
Right.
And also, I presume, handing it to other people who might have been interested in publishing it, although he never said, Harper Row want to do it, so you better hurry up if you want
that.
I never got the impression there was anyone else who was chasing
it. Because he must have been virtually unknown at the time.
Yeah.
Yeah, right.
People
now might know him through this very... it's often been reproduced. You see the image of him with a mask of Rambo. He has this sort of... it's a photograph of Rambo, isn't it, which he turned into a mask and would hold up in front of his own face.
Yeah.
And this has been reproduced many, many times in art magazines and books and this, that, and the other. That's sort of where... I mean, I have no idea what he actually looked like. All I know is this image of Rambo.
He looks a bit like Rambo, actually.
Did he?
Yeah. It's sort of, well, Rambo kind of close up with a slightly distorted lens in it. Actually, it looks nothing like Rambo, but somehow or other.
Right.
The other thing you see, if you don't see him with the Rambo mask in front of him, there's a picture of him with his lips sewed together.
Oh, right.
I think it is, yeah.
Okay.
And some other quite iconic portraits done by a bloke called Peter Hujar.
Oh, yes.
There's
a
pronunciation I don't know. Is it Hujar? Right. H-U-J-A-R.
Yeah.
So that might be Hujar.
Yeah, Hujar.
Whom he lived with.
So did you follow his career? I mean,
if I'd realised he was getting that, if I'd realised he was getting that well known, I would have done more of his work. No, he wasn't doing a lot of written work, and neither was Allos. We're a bit. Pick something up and then put it down again.
Right.
Sort of. There's no real accumulating. That's why we are not, Allos Books is not the captain of industry in terms of the publishing world.
Right. Okay.
It's in the spirit of the
material in a way, isn't
it? Yes, totally ephemeral. That mask that you were talking about, Wojnarowicz did a series of things called the Rambo sequence, I think.
Yeah.
Whatever it was pictures of him in various locations with the mask in front of his face.
I suppose we should explain for people perhaps who are under the age of 40 that Rambo is not... we better spell Rambo for them, don't you think?
R-I-M-B-A-U-D.
Yeah, it's Arthur Rambo, yeah. the French poet associated with Paul Verlaine. Nothing to do with the Rambo films, just in case we...
Yeah, Rambo had a very short career as a writer, and then it wasn't even a career. Then disappeared off to make a living being a trader in East Africa, where he eventually caught some hideous disease of the leg. And came back and died in a Marseille hospital about 20 years later. He was out in Africa about 10 to 15 years. History isn't that accurate, but certainly he never wrote anything after the three or four books that he had done with and off his own bat when he was with Verlaine.
Yeah.
And it was about 6 or 7 years after he left France that Verlaine published something of his, and he was grabbed by the coffee circles in Paris as being the next best thing to sliced pain.
Right. Okay.
Sliced croissant. The best.
But they had a fairly tempestuous relationship.
They used to, Verlaine shot Rambo, and Rambo hit him with a fish.
Right.
I don't know. I've never heard. That's an apocryphal anecdote, but somewhere it must be documented. Whether it's documented by Rambo or Verlaine or by someone else, I don't know. But it's entered into the history as something that you do if you're having a little tiff.
Right.
Hitting with a fish if you and don't
is there,
like could, him.
Is there any particular reason that David Vojnarovich should have identified so closely with Rambo?
Poe Moody. How do you translate that?
Yeah.
The Modic poets, evil poets. How does Poe Moody translate?
I'm not sure. Naughty or something, or kind of...
badly behaved.
Not depraved, exactly, but... It's not decadent, is it?
It's not decadent. It's something a little bit more perverse than naughty.
Yeah.
There's evil involved. It's evil. Evil speaking poets, perhaps.
Okay.
It's a phrase, I don't know where the phrase came from. I saw it just the other day in its original form, quoted by François Mauriac, talking about Genet and how Genet and Rambo were kind of similar, but Rambo was better. He was, for whatever reason, more powerful and more kept his silence longer than.
Yeah.
Although Genet had only just started talking by the time. Mauriac was talking about.
Do you think, should we play a little bit of this Rambo record?
Yeah.
What about that? I mean, that's quite sort of. It is a. If I can find the cover, it's quite a bit of a rarity, I think. It's a double EP called Arthur Rambo Poème Dit par Michel Vitold from Le Club Français du Disque, 1958, and there are many short tracks on it. We could play a bit of. This one is Adieu. Are you familiar with Rambo's?
Not particularly, but quite familiar in translation. Not in the frog.
Saison.
Can I read?
Château, quelle âme est sans défaut. Saison, château, j'ai fait la magique étude du bonheur que nul n'élude. Vive lui, chaque fois que chante le coq gaulois. Mais je n'aurai plus d'envie, il s'est chargé de ma vie. Ce charme, il prit âme et corps, et dispersa tous efforts. Que comprendre à ma parole, il fait qu'elle fuit et vole. Saison, château, fête de la fin. Ma faim, âne, fuit sur ton âne. Si j'ai du goût, ce n'est guère que pour la terre et les pierres. Din, 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 mangeons l'air, le roc, les charbons, le fer. Mes fins tournées, paissez fin, le prédesson, attirez le guévenin des liserons. Mangez les cailloux qu'un pauvre brise, les vieilles pierres d'église. Les galets fils des déluges, pain couché aux vallées grises. Mes fins, c'est les bouts d'air noir, l'azur sonneur. C'est l'estomac qui me tire, c'est le malheur. Sur terre ont paru les feuilles, je vais où chair de fruits blettes. Au sein du sillon je cueille la doucette et la violette. Ma faim, âne, fuit sur ton âne. Adieu.
Okay.
Adieu.
Well, it's just adieu. It's just starting. That's actually the longest track on the whole thing.
Fête de la femme. Was that it's not the Hunger Games, but it's pretty well near it, a translation of Fête de la femme.
Okay. Right.
The Festival of Starvation.
It's a nice little record, isn't it? It's got a bit of a text by René Char, who was the surrealist poet, I think, on the back. Did you want to read a bit from your Seven Sounds, perhaps?
Possibly.
Or later.
Let me just finish what I was saying about Rambo and the mask.
Yes.
The picture that Wojnarowicz used and blew up and did a cutout and stuck it on a piece of wood comes from the cover of the New Directions edition of Illumination, that particular Rambo collection. And you see it appear, the book cover itself appears a couple of times in some of Burroughs's collages.
Oh, right.
Because of, he was favourite of Burroughs as well. Interestingly enough, you see this appear in, in some of these photographs that Burroughs took of assemblage, assembled bits and bobs and on different levels of glass, as these photographs were exhibited a couple of years back at the photographer's gallery. And three or four of them have this book in the background, and I reckon that it's because it had just been reissued by New Directions in the late 50s, when just around the time that they were all together in the Beat Hotel being artists and whatever.
Yeah.
Yes, that photograph is the one that Wojnarowicz used to go around with and in various locations in New York to create a sequence of...
Is the photographer ever credited? I mean, it must be obviously a photograph from the beginning of the 20th century. I mean, it's a...
Don't know.
No, okay. No,
in fact, that's a good question. Who's taking the photographs of Wojnarowicz?
It's not a very sharp photograph, is it? It's a sort of like a quite a blurry image.
Oh, very grainy. We're deep down in
it. Could even just be a detail, couldn't it? They could have picked it out of a sort of face in the crowd almost.
Well, I think it was done as a portrait. I think it's just by the very nature of reproduction.
Right.
It's achieved that grainy texture, if it's a blow up.
Right.
But in fact, I think it's just a degeneracy. Rather goes well.
So, was it part of a performance piece then by Wojnarowicz?
I don't think he sold tickets. He just did it. And then.
Did he just walk around with this mask? Or?
I don't know. No. There are photographs of him in the water, in abandoned buildings by the waterfront down the Lower East Side, which was his favourite haunt for picking up. The mates. And the Waterfront Journals, which was published after he died, was quite a long, bigger collection of these sounds that he had written down for Sounds in the Distance and all the other people he'd met on the road talking about them. Bit hard to tell whether he makes them up or whether they really are transcriptions in a kind of oral history way, or whether a combination of the two, a kind of confabulation. Let's listen to that bloke, Close to the Knives.
So this is an extract from Close to the Knives, a memoir of disintegration. And this CD is basically performed by Jay Aseng, A-A-S-E-N-G, and he reads the whole book out, so it's apparently it's 8 hours of text.
Let's just do a little bit of it.
We'll pick a bit. This is from chapter 2 called Losing the Form in Darkness.
In darkness. It's so simple. The man without the eye against a receding wall. The subtle deterioration of weather, of shading, of images engraved in the flaking walls. See the quiet outline of a dog's head in plaster, simple as the splash of a fish in dreaming, and then the hole in the wall farther along, framing a jagged sky swarming with glints of silver and light. So simple, the appearance of night in a room full of strangers. The maze of hallways wandered, as in films. The fracturing of bodies from darkness into light, sounds of plane engines easing into the distance. It is the appearance of a portrait, not the immediate vision I love so much. That of the drag queen in the dive waterfront coffee shop, turning toward a stranger and giving a coy, seductive smile that reveals a mouth of rotted teeth, but the childlike rogue slipped out from the white-sheeted bed of Pasolini. The image of Jean Genet cut loose from the fine lines of fiction, uprooted from age and time and continent, and hung up slowly behind my back against a tin wall. It's the simple sense of turning slowly, feeling the breath of another body in a quiet room, the stillness shattered by the scraping of a fingernail against a collar line. Turning is the motion that disrupts the vision of fine red and blue lines weaving through the western skies. It is the motion that sets into trembling the subtle water movements of shadows, like lines following the disappearance of a man beneath the surface of an abandoned lake. He was moving in with the gradual withdrawal of light, a passenger on the shadows.
It's a good reading, isn't it?
Yes, I mean,
it's quite engaging. And if anyone wants that, you can actually still pick this up. I think I bought this on, I don't know, Amazon or eBay or one of those things. It was only about sort of, I think it's about £10. It's Close to the Knives by David Wojnarowicz, performed by Jay Asseng, and it's described as an MP3 audio biography.
It was just recently been reissued by Canongate, just 2 or 3 months ago, actually, isn't it, that this came out?
Yes, but I think it's been published before, hasn't it?
Yeah,
I think there's a long few reprints.
It's been out of print since 1991.
Right, okay.
So it's really good that they did it. In fact,
why is it called A Memoir of Disintegration? Can you explain a bit about that?
Well, I bet that's not his subtitle. I'd say that's...
No, you didn't think
no,
not?
No, that's so upset.
Okay.
Well, it sounds like a bit of postmodern editorial interjection there.
Right.
I don't think that's not the kind of language.
But wasn't he known for being an AIDS activist? He died young, didn't he? Like Rambo?
Yeah. He certainly in his later years was terribly angry with the way he felt he was going to die, and the reasons why he felt he was going to die. And I suppose actually A Memoir of Disintegration is probably quite a good subtitle.
Right.
If one takes that as its interpretation, although he was a bit of a depressive, so it's possible that disintegration has much to do
his
with
own
that.
Mental disintegration,
yeah,
right.
As much to do with that as it is to do with his body falling apart. I mean, he was seeing people fall apart in front of him as well.
Yeah.
You know, Peter Hooha died as well. The list, the dedication here in the Canongate, there's a list, the dead. Peter Hooha, Keith Davis, Iola, Montana, Dean Savard, Arthur Bresson, Paul Prevost, Cookie Muller, Paul Feck, Louis Frangela, Ethel Eckelberger, and Vita Russo. I mean, both Cookie Muller and Ethel Eckelberger were performance artists at the same time as he was in that downtown Soho scene.
Right.
In that bar. I don't think it was Danceteria. It's another one.
Mm.
But where Max worked as a busboy, got raided by the police and closed down.
Right.
Bit so like CBGBs.
So you were in New York in the 80s at this time?
70s, that
the
was.
The 70s, this
yeah.
is? Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
And, I'm that old.
I wouldn't know it.
I was only there. I was visiting my mate Max. And what did we do? Yeah, just mucked about. Oh, I'll tell you what I did. I did one of those things where you looked in the newspaper for somebody who wanted their car to be driven from wherever you were to thousands of miles away. And I took this Ford Pinto all the way across America to a place called Juneau near Portland, Oregon.
Right.
It's supposedly a four-day drive, but I think I took at least 8 days because I sort of zigzagged. Zigzagged up to St. Paul. Then I zigzagged down to Buffalo, actually.
In the same car?
In the same car, Buffalo, and then back up to Portland, because in Buffalo I stayed with Burroughs.
Right.
He was there as part of the Naropa Institute thing.
Mm-hmm.
Naropa Institute or the Boulder. Boulder, not
Boulder.
Buffalo. Boulder.
Boulder,
that's
Colorado.
Right. Boulder, Colorado.
Okay.
Not Buffalo.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
And, I just turned up. It was really nice. You know, he said, we went out. Got drunk. And I think I nearly killed him, actually. When we got back from the restaurant, we parked up by the side of the road, and it was one of this road that went at the side of a mountain, or the side of a steep hill, And when he got out of the car,
this
he nearly fell off the pavement down about a 40-foot drop.
Right.
But fortunately, he kept his balance, and he survived. it was exciting and quite heart, it made my heart beat.
Well, that's appropriate tape recording in the background then.
This is a learning tape.
Pansystolic regurgitant murmur, also called holosystolic. This type of murmur is caused by backward flow through the heart. Since the blood pressure remains higher throughout systole in the ejecting chamber than in the receiving chamber, the murmur is continuous throughout systole, beginning with the first sound and ending with the second sound. Pansystolic murmurs are found in mitral regurgitation, tricuspid regurgitation, and ventricular septal defect. The following recording will introduce a pansystolic murmur having an even intensity throughout systole.
How's your heart these days?
It's fine. I found this in the car boot sale. Irresistible.
Right. It's not a million miles from Burroughs's tone in a way, is it? It's kind of the voice of the commentator. This
really
sort of,
sharp.
This sort of flat monotone. It's a sort of,
yeah, I think there must be something to do with microphones from those days. I mean, that dates from the 80s, I think.
Does it? But right.
There's something about microphones that take a voice like Burroughs and that American voice.
Yeah.
Or maybe it's just smoking, I don't know. that puts a kind of edge on it.
So what's your... Did you want to read anything from Seven Sounds, or do you want to move on to your next publication?
Let's move on to my next publication.
Okay, or your next research, I should say.
Although, let me just go back to that systole, he calls it. Systole,
yeah.
I think, or systolic.
Early systolic murmur.
Yeah. When I
early
had a
systolic
bit of a, I had a bit of a kind of, it's called a mini stroke, about 10 years ago now. The doctors weren't too sure why it was. I felt a little bit ill and whatever. It was just saying, oh, I'm feeling a bit dizzy and my eyelids flickering and I think I better stop driving. And I'm telling you this story because this is a medical program now. Okay?
Indeed. Yeah, we've moved into another realm now.
And just in case anybody else suddenly feels a little bit weird when they're driving, stop driving. Pull over. And we went to Whittington. And they weren't too sure why, because there were no more symptoms.
Right.
And then one of the doctors, he put his stethoscope, listened to my heart, and then listened to the blood going through my the aorta that goes up either side of your neck. And he said, and what he could hear was a little noise, or what they call in medical parlance, a bruit. Which is French for noise.
Yeah.
And it was that last bit of the recording there where you hear that kind of rushing sound.
Yes.
Where there's that little rush, rush, rush. If you hear that in your arteries, it means they're a bit clogged.
Yes.
And he saw, well, that's clearly a problem. And that's possibly what's caused you to feel a little bit weird, and we'll have that out sharpish, mate.
Oh, really?
Kept me in, and dug around in it.
What did they take out then?
Gunge.
Right, from your arteries.
Yeah,
from just one part of the arteries.
Yeah, part of the artery. Apparently, it's there are certain places in your arteries where this gunge, cholesterol fat actually accumulates, and in your neck. And there's one down across your stomach.
Is that the word they call an aortic aneurysm or something?
Yeah.
Yes.
And the guy said the anaesthetist said, look, we recommend that you have a local anaesthetic, or you can have a general.
Yeah.
And I said, I'd rather have a general. Mm. He said, we recommend you have a local anaesthetic, because if you have a general anaesthetic, we don't find out whether your blood supply to the brain was doing very well during the operation until after we can't wake you up.
Oh, right. Okay.
So I'm lying on my side, and there's this guy with... You could hear the guy's the surgeon talking, you know.
Yeah.
Right. Can you pass that? Can you tie that artery up? Please, hurry up. You know. What's going on here? And then the guy, the anaesthetist, asks you for your telephone number. I said, why does this man want to know my telephone number in the middle of an operation?
Yeah.
It's part of this. I think
just
it's called
to see if you're conscious.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Glasgow.
Right.
The Glasgow scale of awareness, I think it is.
Right, right. Okay.
So, hang on.
Yeah.
Next project.
Yeah.
Genet.
So, yes, your next project. So your publication, is this out yet, or is this a pending publication?
No, it's... the next project, another mini Mimeo, I'm going to be doing with Jeremy Reed.
Oh,
and,
yes.
And that's a poem sequence based in Soho. Very Rambo, actually, now I come to think of it.
Uh-huh.
Jeremy is a poet.
I know him from he wrote a book about John Stephen and Carnaby Street, and I think he wrote something about the Rolling Stones.
Yes,
But also many books of poetry, of course.
Books of poetry,
yeah.
And one of his most recent ones was the thing about the Dilly Boys, about Piccadilly and the boys in the Dilly.
Yeah,
that Johnny Go Home kind of thing that was slightly touched on by Jake Arnott. In his book, Johnny Go Home, or was it Johnny Come Home? One of those.
Yeah.
And then the other project I've got is I'm working on a paper I'm doing for the European Beat Studies Network conference in Paris at the end of September, where I'm looking at the notes that Burroughs made in his copy of the Genet biography written by Edmund White. And it's 600 pages. It's a proof copy, and he's done all these margin notes in it, and he's used the book also as a place to record his dreams. So he's by his bedside, and then wakes up in the middle of the night whenever he wrote his dreams down, and he's got dreams halfway through, dreams on the back cover, things about tornadoes. His dreams are a lot about tornadoes, and I think there's something about people who come from the Midwest that tornadoes feature highly in their subconscious as things you need to be worried about, because clearly these are not dreams of joy when the tornado comes along, and they seem to be associated with anxiety. So there's that. Looking at what he's noting there.
Right.
Where were we? I don't know. How about another bit of Burroughs talking on that CD?
Indeed. Okay.
You should come on soon and tell us.
I'm expanding states of consciousness in myself, and I hope in the readers as well.
Yeah.
I feel that any writer is
in the... What's his first one? Let's see.
Bones glistening, arms flailing like in some stream, backstroking his way out of this world, out of this life, away from this sea of blue uniforms and white boneless faces, away from this sea of city heat and faraway motion of his eyes fluttering behind dark sunglasses. Walked onto the pier and stood with my back to the river, and way over the movements of the city was what looked like a falling star, a photographic negative of one in the night. A jet streak short and vertical falling from the sky, like a falling jet with a single illuminated flame tracing the domed curve of the heavens, a scratch in the sky, a blinding light caught in the scratch from the unseen sun, and slowly changing direction and connecting the rooftops of the buildings one after the other. In the warehouse just before dark, passed along the hallways and photographed the various graffiti on the walls, some of hermaphrodites and others of...
Well, that's another extract from Close to the Knives by David Vojnarovich. So you were saying, Jim Pennington. Jim Pennington is the guest on Wavelength this week, and you have a new publication forthcoming, Edmund White on Jean Genet. But you're going to a conference or something?
No, the conference is in Paris, European Beat Studies, a loose association of academics in beat studies, but they allow ordinary old independent scholars like me to come along. I'm making it sound a bit silly, but it's actually quite a serious conference where they what I'm doing is it's quite a mixed bunch that go there, actually. Performance artists Eric Anderson's and Ramucho Mata are doing a closing musical piece at the end. There's a session where a couple of rare book people talk about odd manuscripts that they've come across. Oh, Third right. Mind books. He does a nice thing. Hmm.
Is it open to the public, this conference, or do you have
it's open to the public. You have to be seriously committed to sit through it. You have to be very interested.
When is this? When does it take place?
September the 20th through to the 22nd.
Right.
In Paris.
In Paris. Do you know where?
The Chicago University is the name of it. Seems an odd name, but it's down. Yeah. It's down on the down by the Seine in the middle.
Yeah.
Of Paris. And the thing I'm doing is talking about this proof copy that Burroughs had. Put all these annotations in the proof copy of Edmund White's biography of Genet, which Edmund White, I got to be able to talk to him just a couple of days ago, didn't know that Burroughs had had done this, had read so carefully the biography and had made all these notes inside, and he was pleased to hear that. He did say that Grauholtz had told Edmund that one of the reasons why Burroughs wrote My Education, which is very nearly his last book, was he was inspired to read it, to write it, because he just read Genet's Prisoner of Love, which was Genet's posthumous last book, and it made him realise that even at his age, when he was beginning to feel he couldn't write anymore because he didn't have the discipline to write, in the same way he had when he was doing the Western trilogies. Here was Genet writing in a very unstructured and random way.
Really?
In Prisoner of Love, and he felt he could do the same. It inspired him to write his own last book, which was My Education, which is a collection of dreams and a really loose, structured piece of writing.
Right.
So that's what makes this annotated biography fascinated. It's full of dreams, and it's full of his observations about Genet. I say full. I mean, you're reading through, and there's something gets underlined, and suddenly you're back into this position of reading it as if you're watching Burroughs read it. And you see the things that he underlines. What are the things he underlines that were typical? I've been reading it really carefully and I still can't remember. He underlines the things where Genet is annoyed with Sartre's attitude to him. He underlines a lot about Burroughs, about Genet's time spent in this boy's home, a bit like a borstal called Maitrey. Which totally formed Genet's character, having to be in a home for effectively orphans.
Will you be publishing this eventually?
No. It won't be a publication.
Oh, I see.
It won't be a publication.
Okay.
It is just a study. It'd be a bit of a loose study because I'm going to be treating it as unseriously as possible. I've got this little image at the moment. I want to get a still from Porridge, the thing with Ronnie Barker and God Bar. Right. We're going to collar Genet as Ronnie Barker, and he's going to be looking at Godba in the corner. He's going to say, "Hey, Godba, qu'est-ce que tu lis là-bas? What are you reading down there?" Is it "À la recherche des cuisses perdues"? In remembrance of lost thighs.
Right.
Is the loose translation.
Okay. Well, thank you very much to Jim Pennington, head researcher for ALO's books, for coming in today to Wavelength. Thanks a lot for coming in, Jim.
And, no, thank you.
Good luck with your conference.
Thanks.
We'll go out with some heartbeats.
Pitched mid to late diastolic murmur is produced, which is normally heard best at the apex. The following example will present each feature of mitral stenosis. We shall begin by increasing the intensity of the first sound.
This program has been brought to you by Resonance 104.4 FM. If you liked what you heard and want to support our work, please make a donation at fundraiser.resonance.fm.